Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com for those of you online. This week, Breaking the Spell of Money. A musical treat with Tim Herford from the local band The Transpersonals here in Bristol. We'll be looking at the music industry, free festivals, Druids and Glastonbury, which of course was started by Arabella Churchill. Then James Files. How terrible is our propagandised media? Mainstream media from London. The JFK assassin James Files has confessed, but the London media haven't told us. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also, you can go via Volunteering Bristol, if you like, on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And I'm joined now by Timothy Herford. Tim, you're from the band The Transpersonals. Mm-hmm. And I think what might be nice is to play something from your band when we finished our little chat. Tell us just a bit about how the band got going.
It got going back in...
You mean we?
We got going back in 2006. You know, we've been doing this for 10 years. And we just make music, put it out there and try and cover as much of the most interesting things I can think of in terms of topics, you know, and subjects to put into the songwriting. So it's a psychedelic band.
Okay, it's nice that you're a psychedelic band because, in a way, music kind of in the 1960s and 70s started going in that direction and it kind of hit a brick wall. I don't know what you make of what's happened to music over the last 30, 40 years, but I can remember reading 1999, I think, when it first came out, a book by Francis Stonor Saunders called The Cultural Cold War, which was all about how the US, the CIA specifically, but obviously in cooperation with other intelligence services in the NATO countries, had decided that they didn't want anti-war protesters, you know, making million-dollar hit singles and doing really well in the music industry. So they decided to try and close the whole thing down. That there's also very strong evidence that Jimi Hendrix was killed by MI6. His manager was working with MI6. Jimmy sacked his manager, and within the week, he was dead. There are a whole load of them. There's a lot of conspiracy theories, but some of them very interesting around the death of Bob Marley. Loads of people through them, and I think probably the most recent one I would point to as a possible suspicious death is that of Joe Strummer from The Clash, who was writing very anti-American songs in the 1980s. And started to do anti-war on terror benefits gigs, and then he dropped dead as well. So there seem to be a kind of dark forces out there trying to squash the music industry. So I'll shut up. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, well, obviously he clashed with the wrong forces, but there's a really, really great book called Strange Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon or something like that, but it's by an author called Dave McGowan, and he wrote a really great book about what was going on in a place called Laurel Canyon in California in the 1960s. So you had all those people you mentioned, like Jim Morrison, Frank Zappa, Mamas and Papas, even Charles Manson, loads of people, the Beach Boys, all hanging out in the same tiny little, what would be like a tiny little village, you know, in California.
Just to add to that book, there's another one, John Potash's book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, because he saw the idea of the drug culture in music as being a double-edged sword. Not only was it interesting creatively, but also the authorities could spike musicians with drugs, maybe like just before they were about to do a performance, and it would kind of disrupt their ability to do a powerful anti-war message.
I think the government, you know, allowed a kind of experiment to happen in the 1960s where they unleashed LSD. And I think if you look into that book, for example, you'll see that Jim Morrison's father was actually played a lead role in the start of the Vietnam War. He was the one that called in the message to say that the boat had been, you know,
this is the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Yeah, and Morrison's father, George Morrison, was admiral in the U.S. Navy. Yeah. And it's interesting, I remember as a youngster reading up a bit about Morrison and the Doors, and Jim Morrison kept saying, people would ask him, where's your father? My father's dead.
Yeah, he used to say that the myth I grew up with, being a Doors fan, and this is in the 80s, mind you, after, you know, this is way past the time of the Doors. But as a kid, I was into the 60s music. And it was very clear to me. I can remember believing that his parents were killed and he was kind of raised on the side of the road by Indians or something like that.
That was his myth, I think.
Yeah,
he put out,
but his dad was actually military intelligence, and he grew up with Frank Zappa, whose dad was also military intelligence, and they were all military intelligence fathers. So I think there was some kind of MK Ultra experiment where they go, we're going to encourage all these kids when they're young to be as creative as they can. This is speculation based upon things like the book I've read, etc., and facts that you can read. And so they kind of groomed these kids to be really creative, do you know what I mean? And they were, and it worked, and they were brilliant songwriters. So you know, controlled opposition. We'll have the war over here going on, and we'll also have the rebellion against it led by our children. Do you know what I mean? When it gets too big and we want to shut the experiment down, we will, which they did with Charles Manson. Boom, that's the end of the Summer of Love, right? Hippies are now sort of psychotic LSD cult member weirdos. You know, so.
Well, Manson was very interesting. He was also trying to kind of get a race war started. I can remember reading about the attacks, the Sharon Tate murders, because of course Roman Polanski was doing some amazing films at the time, things like the Fearless Vampire Killers. Absolutely brilliant film. If you look at it back at it now, you think, well, what is this rubbish that they're churning out today? And when his house was broken into by Manson and his friends, there were messages daubed in blood on the wall, which were made to look like it had actually been black activists that had come in and done the murders.
Yeah.
So this was quite a sophisticated psyop, really.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know where the trying to start a race war thing comes into it. That sounds to me like that was the CIA trying to do something like that through him. It didn't quite come off. So they just said, okay, well, we'll have it as the end of the hippie movement.
Well,
and what happened at Altamont with the Rolling Stones concert, where some people got stabbed or something by the Hells Angels. Remember that? It was almost like they tried to kill the spirit of the hippie movement with trauma, like they do with the PSYOP, which was the Manson and the Altamont.
Well, I think maybe we should just find one of your songs and play it now, and then we'll go on to talk about what we were going to talk about, which was history, British history, and some of the stuff that we're not talk about in schools, and Stonehenge, because that actually ties in beautifully what you're talking about, because there was the whole Stonehenge Free Festival movement in Britain in the 1960s and 70s, which then got kind of taken over by the government. But anyway, what song of yours would you like us to play?
Why not play Happy Holidays?
This is a vintage Rouge 50mm changing cylinder music box. Let's listen to this play.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a song called Happy Holidays by the band The Transpersonals. I wrote that song. It combines in the lyrics the subjects of Advaita, which is direct inquiry into the nature of self, Disney propaganda, and the fact that we're a god. We're a god. We're a drug that God takes called a human being. We're made of chemicals. It wears off after about 80 odd years. Don't worry about it too much.
We're a god. That's a bit of an interesting Freudian slip.
We're a drug.
An interesting Freudian slip because
that God takes.
I was reading recently. I mean, we're talking about history here, about the development of various kinds of ideas of God, from the Egyptians where they had kind of animal headed gods, through to the Romans where they had human headed gods.
Planets as gods.
Right the way through to the idea of people being gods, which is what I think in a weird way we've got today. We've got some people who have got such massive egos, such vast amounts of money, that they really do think they can do anything.
Yeah.
So there's a little quick view of history. But anyway, look, we were talking about festivals, Stonehenge, the music scene, and I think in Britain as a centre for free festivals in the 1960s, Stonehenge was the place. Mm. What do you make of what Stonehenge actually is as a kind of, you know, is it as a place to visit?
Well, I was there on a solstice a few years ago. It was quite good fun.
When I've driven past it on the solstice, it didn't look like much good fun to me because they had people kind of almost in cages, kind of behind big fences, thousands of people in, I'm thinking about Avebury, actually, where the police are sort of a fairly low profile, but the idea that it's fun seems to be marred by the fact that you've got everyone being penned in.
Mm. Out as well, because they can't have thousands of people turn up. I mean, once you get to a certain amount of people...
Hang on. You can't have certain type of people turning up.
Well, the local council or whatever would be like, this place is just going to get wrecked if we just allow
it. But it doesn't. This is the thing. I think, certainly in the 60s, they realised, and the 70s, they realised that people can actually have a free festival. Mm. Those free festivals were... I think Bowie did a really good Memory of a Free Festival song about it, didn't he? Which was a sort of captured that spirit of the idea of tens of thousands of people getting together, basically making a kind of nomad's city in the middle of nowhere in the English countryside and the Wiltshire Downs, and everything passing off rather peacefully, actually, and without the authorities.
They've turned that into a Glastonbury Festival, haven't they?
It's been surrounded by
Everything gets monetized, capitalized on, do you know what I mean? And then you have to buy a ticket, and then the standard of it in one way goes up, the safety goes up, everything's, but then the kind of freedom, the spirit of freedom, which disappears. And you end up with what you were talking about earlier on, where's the music industry gone? Well, the problem is that we have the problem with the music industry is that it's an industry. It's the word industry that's the problem. So if you're going to take all of your music, if you're into music and everything that you digest comes through the television, that's the same thing as only ever going into town and eating McDonald's or Burger King. I mean, if you want a decent restaurant, you're really into food, you're going to go off the beaten track, because the industry is just a ephemeral. You know, it's just an electrical light show coming through the television that's got massive funding, and it's got nothing to do with music. It's got to do with selling pin-up stars to kids.
You're making me think about the Monkees, right, which was a kind of, you know, manufactured band. You had a lot of...
They were
lot
still
of,
good, though. They still had songwriters behind them and stuff like
but,
that.
But, okay, so you've got the idea
They still
of
cared that
people,
the music was
People
good.
Who had the right faces, the right voices... you've got a producer who's saying, well, here's someone who's going to write a song for you, etc. So rather than it being a bunch of people that get together, there's a synergy there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about you and your band, really, and that something is produced out of that synergy. It seems as if the parts have been kind of broken apart after the, you know, halfway through the musical revolution of the 60s and 70s, and divided into their little pieces, and then kind of almost like reinvented, like almost a doppelganger of what the original successful bands were. But anyway, look, Stonehenge, not far from here, round about 1500 BC. I mean, what's your thoughts about what was really going on there?
1500 BC. Let's just skip forward a bit.
All right.
And just to finish off with the, you know, they brought in punk and the Sex Pistols and all that, which was as manufactured as the Monkees, as manufactured as Boyzone by Malcolm McLaren, right? So they just, they don't, anyway, but so let's go back to 1500 BC.
If we can.
When I think of England, 1500 BC, I'm seeing men with white beards and, you know, walking around with robes, like living in kind of in the forest, in wooden structures, dancing around, and almost something like akin to Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit.
Yeah, so druids, I mean, they were into, what do we know about the druids? They were into their...
I don't know if that's true or not.
They were into their parasites, weren't they?
Were they?
That's that, well, yeah.
The archons?
Well, oak trees they were definitely into, but also mistletoe was apparently one of the things that the druids were into. I mean, actually, mistletoe is, you know, it's a very powerful herb that can be used to treat people, apparently for cancer. There are some people who say that that's a really good treatment for cancer in some ways. But so the druids were into their nature, but then the thing that always troubled me a bit about Stonehenge, and we'll get on to how it was kind of remanufactured in the 1950s in a minute, but was the discovery of human sacrifices underneath the stones.
Right.
Yeah, so okay. When the stones were put there, yes, they were travelled from, you know, came over the blue stones that came over from Wales, etc. But there were human sacrifices discovered underneath the stones. And this is something that people don't like to think about, the Celts. I mean, they were pretty wild, these Beowulf-style characters. But there was also this, you know, kind of rather frightening aspect to the priesthood being very powerful. So don't cross what the priesthood says. Yeah. In a way, it's a bit like capitalism has become. You know, if you don't get the money, then I'm afraid you're going to be evicted. You're going to starve. Yeah. Mm. So there is this dark side to right way back then. Mm. So it wasn't Stonehenge to do with the solstices. What do you make of it all?
I know a druid.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think anyone really has got, like, knows exactly what the purpose and true purpose and intent behind Stonehenge
was. The winter
was.
Solstice, I mean, surely there was something going on there. And there's also the way it's aligned with the sun. So the idea is that there's something happens there, the summer solstice, to mark the point that the year stops getting warmer and starts getting colder. And the same in the winter, where the year stops getting colder and starts getting warmer. And I may be wrong about this, but I think that the Druid priest class, they kind of captured this idea of we are the ones who know which day it's going to change. And everyone's watching the sun thinking it's going up and up and up and down and down. And this was used to kind of spellbind the general public in a similar way to the money people are spellbinding us today.
Anyway, well, yeah. I mean, the whole purpose of sacrificing human beings never made any sense to me whatsoever. I mean, you look at the myths and they tell you, well, they believed that by doing this, they would have a fertile crop. Because it would appease the whatever goddess of corn.
Isn't it about fear?
But that's what they're telling the people. But what they're actually doing is they're demonstrating that we are such psychopaths that if you don't fall in line with us, we can quite easily chop off all of your heads in front of you like this and not even raise an eyebrow. So don't mess with us. That's the actual message that's going into the everyone that's witnessing these sacrifices.
Yeah.
It's basically, and the whole corn goddess thing is just a cover story, because what they're really doing is they're demonstrating visually to you what they're capable of doing. So
it's a powerful, important site stone.
I would assume.
An important sort of symbol in British history and in our minds about what British history means. Stonehenge is quite important. And interesting that it was allowed, this a bit like the music industry, the festival was allowed to build up at Stonehenge, and then at a certain point it was like, no. In fact, it was the mid-1980s, wasn't it? There was a peace convoy, and there was something called the Battle of the Beanfield, where the police basically smashed up all the coaches that were heading to Stonehenge for the festival.
Yeah.
And this was a symbolic smashing of that whole entire idea that people can just get together in the countryside and do what they want.
It's very difficult for people to do that. The rave scene, which I was never involved in, I missed out on that, unfortunately. Because I was just about the right age to have got into that as a teenager, but I was doing other things. I was trying to make my way as a stand-up comedian. And anyway. I missed out on the rave scene, but my friends, you know, Nathan, who produces the band, the Transpersonals, by the way, he was very involved in that. He used to DJ in it. You know, as a 14-year-old even, he was, you know, sneaking out and going to all these raves. And he always, when I ask him to talk about it, because it's very interesting, he always glows with a real fond memory and talks about the connection that all these thousands of people had and how amazing it was that somebody would just organize something in a field somewhere. Everyone at the last minute would find out where it was, and then all these people from around the country would converge into this field. And they'd all take E and stuff like that and be on drugs. But the attitude,
not everybody, of course.
But what I'm saying is there wasn't any real trouble there, as he's recounted to me. It was quite the opposite. It was a wonderful experience. And then, of course, for some reason, the establishment, they just don't want people self-organising in that way.
Well, I think that it's fair to say.
You buy a ticket, we've cordoned off this area. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, back in the early 2000s, I can remember I went along to one of these raves in Bristol, organised by Gedge. I don't know if you've come across him. He's a squatter, organises right. These sort of... parties and some of his friends, and lo and behold, there were no police around at all. They said the far right will be here later, and sure enough, they came about 3 a.m. a whole bunch of right wing people, because the police knew there's no point in us going, we're going to send these nasty people in too to disrupt. So there's definitely also been an attempt to bring violence into those peaceful deliberately in order to again destabilize it in a similar way to the Battle of the Beanfield with Stonehenge. But look, I mean, okay, so I don't know quite where we're going.
Well, how do you know that Stonehenge wasn't actually just erected as a tourist attraction with a mystery behind? How do you know that the Sphinx wasn't cut out of the sandstone in the 1700s by the French Foreign Legion as a tourist attraction?
I think this mystery that everyone's
distracted by.
Okay, well, I do think, I mean, the archaeology... evidence, Wessex Archaeological Trust, etc., will point you to various bits of, archaeological evidence finds in certain strata saying, well, actually, this was being used 1,500 years ago, and we know because of this and this and this, right? So I think there was definitely something happening there. I suppose the question about Stonehenge, really, is the changes that there have been recently, more recently, within our lifetimes even, the right sort of thing. Because 1954... there was a complete, this. Many people don't realise this. They sent the diggers in and they sent archaeologists in, as they used to do in those days. They could never get away with it now, to just sort of put the stones back that they thought had fallen off and reconstruct the whole thing, or most of it anyway.
So are there – I've looked for this. We can look right now, but how did it look before they did that?
Well, there were several of the lintels, which are the bits that run across, that had fallen down. So they actually lifted them back on. So they did, I suppose, a reasonably tasteful job. And obviously, they're not going to put lintels back on that are then going to fall off again. Mm. But where they could see that it was from a specific point, they basically reconstructed. Did a kind of, reconstruction job on Stonehenge. Yeah.
But once again, that's our... I don't know if we were talking about this whilst we were recording or not, but going back to history, our history, which basically is kind of, Rome, ancient Greece, going back to Mesopotamia or whatever, but then we've got Egypt, Rome, Greece, the British Empire, but there's all this other stuff going on as well. And in South Africa, all across Africa, you've got these stone circles that are built with no way in and no way out. So they're these big stone...
Well, like a wall?
Yeah, like a circular wall covering thousands, I think, of miles. And nobody knows, has any idea why that is. Like, what were they keeping in there? Just like farm animals or something? But there's no way in and no way out.
I think it's just
another example of a mystery that isn't just Western, if you know.
One of the things that comes back to me again and again, looking, back through... British history particularly, is the number of invasions is absolutely unbelievable here. We've had wave upon wave upon wave. It seems like as soon as people manage to kind of settle down into a little village, do some stone craft, some sort of craft, whether it's to do with weaving, making cloth, that all of a sudden there's another invasion. Hence, when the Normans turned up, we're skipping ahead of Rome and the Anglo-Saxons, but when the Normans turned up, it was ripe for, I suppose, a different sort of invasion. That is to say, when they you've set yourself up a nice little society, a little bit like the 60s music scene, You've got something going. The Normans come in and they say, well, okay, we're going to chop the heads off of all the dukes and we're going to put our people in charge of all those and we're just going to carry on as if nothing's happened. But now we're in charge.
Yeah, and that was... really where it all started, because I want to know where a British history, like the monarchy, really began, because that's a starting point, isn't it? Definitely. And then, because from that sprang everything that led to the Industrial Revolution, because we had the Navy from Henry VIII.
Well, you know what, right? Was most...
was cannons. And then we started to sort of turn into this emperoristic, that's what I mean, do you know what I mean? We went and then went to conquer, and we did.
Well, the British are the bullies of the world. We were the bullies of the world. We're not anymore. I mean, although maybe people like Boris Johnson like to think through using soft power, we will be and can be. But the main thing, I suppose, about the Normans was the Doomsday Book, because this was about nailing this whole business of the land. Now, the land being an absolutely key part of everything, really. Like, we all need it. Also, the land is a free gift to mankind, isn't it?
Well,
And so how can the Normans come along and say, well, actually, no, it's not. And if you want a bit of land, you're going to have to pay us however many cows a year in order to have it.
Yeah, this is where the problem starts, you know. So, you know, people have wacky ideas and then they force them on everyone else.
But it's not wacky. It's to do with control, surely. There is a very much definite reason behind it. People say, well, surely there's a big mistake happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. Actually, it's not a mistake, is it? Because that's exactly what they wanted to happen. Mm. It's a scenario where you go in and you lose, and that's what you wanted. You just wanted to destabilise the country. That's all you, and you've done it.
Mm. Yeah.
So, anyway, back to the Normans. Anything strike you about them particularly? I mean, we had William the Conqueror, probably the most successful fighter against William was Hereward, this guy in Ely, the island of Ely in East Anglia. Ran around circles around the Normans after they arrived and gave them a real hard time. That's at that point the British started, the upper class started talking French, and they did until I think probably in a few hundred years after that. But I think, you know, we've just got a little bit of a lack of our knowledge about how we got here. Do you think it's important? Do you think maybe we can just ignore it and carry on? Or do you think our history is important?
It depends, doesn't it? Because our everyday lives, personal lives, this stuff you could say is irrelevant in a way, because what is actually relevant is my relationship with my friends, family and stuff, you know, general day-to-day affairs, and what I want to do with my own life and how I want to experience that. So why should I bother to, you know, every day's new. There is only right now. You know, why worry about all that stuff? But all of that stuff is part of our lives because it's there. Do you know what I mean? And, for example, I don't know how far to take it, but, like, you know, we live under the spell of history. History is people have spelled out what happened, but we don't really know what happened. You know, I mean, we don't. And even the very sort of ground beneath our feet and where we live and our nature in the cosmos and everything else is up for question, really, because we get all that from authority. We get all that from scientists.
History is a bit like a kind of lead weight. It's left a bad legacy. It's almost like, you know, the sort of legacy that is left through the government building up massive debt, which is what they're doing right now.
Well, there's another,
you know,
another
on the next generation. Though that next generation is supposed to pay that debt back, you know, so you're born into the world only to be told, well, I'm really sorry, somebody made a massive mistake in 2008, and there's a £5 trillion national debt, and you're just going to have to sit on a little hamster's treadmill for the rest of your life to pay it back.
But if you understand, like, what the Federal Reserve Bank is in America, or if you understand the way that money works and that it's all just debt and it's not backed up by anything, it really is information these days on a hard drive somewhere in a computer.
Well, we've hardly talked about it.
And somebody owns that computer, or a group of people own that computer.
Well, the Bitcoin computer as well. But look, the Romans, it was the Romans that introduced money. There was obviously barter beforehand, and there were valuables, and there were things which were easily, you know. But in order to, you know, there was no such thing as I'm going to pay rent before the Romans turned up. You had to give service to your lord of the manor, but it wasn't money. So money is actually one of the key things to understanding history, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, is the history of money? History is money. History is the history of money, isn't it? Really, if you think about it. Because that's where it all started. when they cast that spell upon everyone, property, owning property and this and that and whatever. Culture, civilization is actually the opposite of civilization. It's just bullying.
I suppose
when I was at school, this kid said to me one time, he said, do you know what, having me on. But he was like, yeah, I know all about the occult. And he said, if you sign your name on this piece of paper, and I signed it on a piece of paper, and then he lifted up his hand and it said, I agree to sell my soul to Colin Cross, which was his name, right? And he said, you've signed it now. And he said, all right. And I felt really bad, like, because he was a really smart, charismatic guy. And I was only like 11 or something. I was like, oh. He said, all right, give me your dinner money and I'll give you your soul back. And I gave him my dinner money to get my soul back. And that money is just the same trick. It's not exactly the same trick, but it really is just symbols,
you know,
contracts. None of these things are real. You know?
We don't need it. This is the point. We do not need money. We really don't. And we could have a very, very happy, wealthy, healthy society without it. There's several people who've just said, well, I'm not going to have any and I'm not going to use it. I'm not going to. And as we just as we think and look at this, there is the Bank of England is saying they're pushing this idea of a cashless society. So they want to get rid of cash, even though we've got billions of pounds of cash flowing around. They're talking about getting rid of it completely. Electronic money is a kind of basically a credit system like they had in ancient Egypt, which is you don't actually have anything valuable. You're not allowed to. We just keep a little ledger of how much money you've got. And that's where we're going with this. And microchipping, human microchipping.
Yeah, well, we're heading down a funnel, which is hard to get out of. I mean,
the way to get out of it is just to have nothing to do with money. But is that
but
feasible?
That's hard, because then you have to sacrifice the lifestyle, the technological lifestyle that we've got to some degree, unless you've got money and you can buy yourself a nice little yurt somewhere and have Wi-Fi and all that. But if you've literally got no money, what
are you
going to do?
Get
build
food?
A wooden hut?
Even if you've got a yurt, how are you going to get your food?
Well, but we say, well, we've all become addicted. You know, well, what are you going to do? Someone's got to provide the electricity for your light bulbs. Someone's got to, you know, maintain the plumbing system. You need to pay all this. So if you want to take part in modern society and have all the comforts of it and all that you want to be able to do your YouTube channel and all that, then you've got to earn money. There's no way around it, because we're all in it together, right? We're all stuck in this money spell. But then you don't have to go back that far when people did actually live more rurally and they did have an opportunity to grow their own vegetables and stuff like that.
This is what I suppose
we're dependent. Everything's got a
we're leading towards here is how do we break that spell? Give us your take.
Well, you can learn to be happy with very, very little money. And just, you know, if you're having discomfort in life and stress about money, then why is that? Because if you're not enjoying, if you're earning money and you really enjoy how you're earning that money, right? So if I'm going for a period of my life, say, and all of a sudden I'm earning enough money to pay my rent and stuff like that through just doing my music, I'm happy. It's only when you're doing something you don't want to do just for the money that you feel like a slave.
I think one of the
most people are stuck in. And
let me interrupt you for a second. It's a really important principle here, where maybe we can start breaking that spell, is by making a commitment to yourself to say, I will not work for anybody I don't respect.
Well, that's one thing.
And Isn't that stage one?
But also, what I was getting at with that is try to figure out what it is that you can do that you enjoy doing to earn money, right? And you might not earn as much money as if you might have to quit your £40,000 a year job in whatever the insurance company, you know. But if you want to dress up as a woman and dance around and be a singer in a whatever it is you want to do, is what I'm saying. Is you're better off doing that than you are, you know, just being stuck in a situation where you're afraid.
The real power of this spell is it starts to get right into our soul, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And we start making all our decisions based on, oh, okay, I'm going to make more money like this. This car is going to be better for me because it's a cheaper car or because it's a better value car, whatever. All of our decisions start – we don't make decisions based on our dreams or our morals.
Yeah.
We start making them more money.
Yeah.
So that spell's got to be broken. Anyway, look.
And don't forget, it's hard if you've got kids as well, because a lot of people out there with kids that are like, oh yeah, you're living in a utopian dream world. I've got two kids to look after. Yeah, I get that. If I had a kid tomorrow, I'd have, you know, there'd be sacrifices on the other end I'd have to make. Yeah, I'm going to go and get a job. You know what I mean? I have to.
Well, so this is a fascinating theme, and I think we'll have to pick it up in some future time, yeah. Tim. Breaking the spell of money.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. We can figure this out together.
Breaking the spell of money. I think we'll be going there again with Tim Herford in future weeks. And the Transpersonals website's thetranspersonals.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, James Files, he's the man from the Chicago Mafia, the hitman, former person from the US Army trained by the 82nd Airborne Division, who shot John F. Kennedy, the president. Our mainstream media from London is propagandized. So why haven't we heard from the JFK assassin? He's confessed, but nobody's told us. Let's go back to our series now with James Files, the JFK assassin. And I will say, anyone of a nervous disposition or for young people, please switch off now, because it's pretty frightening being told about how someone, the President of the United States, was murdered.
I walked around the railroad yard and I was waiting for the time to pass. Time was coming on. And when I heard the roar of the crowd, I'd been over by the fence, and I got there a few minutes early. I'd reached down, I'd taken the scope off the weapon, and I'd look up, and I'd look over the fence, and I would looking for people. What I was looking for was not to see who I knew, but I was looking for people that would be carrying a bulge like up under their arm. I'm looking for somebody with a weapon. This way I have an idea.
Looking for security people?
I'm looking for security people. Cops, undercover, security, off-duty, whoever might be carrying a weapon. Bulge along their hip, behind their back, like I say, under the arm in a shoulder holster. I'm looking for these little bulges. Most people don't pay no attention to that. But this is what I'm looking for. Eugene Braden, he was there that day. He was the, Eugene Braden was there for a specific reason. He had the contacts inside the Dow Tech building. And he was the one that Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli needed to get him into a private office somewhere or another. I have no idea where that office was. I was never in the Dow Tech building myself. So I can't even describe anything in there. And I stayed away from the fence. I stayed basically in the yard, walk over the fence, look over it, spend a minute, then walk back away again. And I was observing the area.
Were you a smoker at the time?
Oh, yes, I did smoke.
Were you smoking cigarettes that morning?
I had smoked that day. Careless. I probably stepped on several cigarette butts and left them there, most of them Pall Mall. This was just a few minutes before the motorcade got there. But like I say, before the motorcade ever arrived on scene and I took the scope off, I didn't have the gun up over the fence. I didn't want nobody to panic at that point. But I had a little scope up my hand and I could look over the fence and I could kind of check and see who it was. I was looking for security people, you know, for somebody carrying, somebody packing. Because I want to know who's got weapons when I go to leave there.
That fence kind of makes an L shape, you know.
Yeah, it's on and off, yeah. It's long arrow to short arrow, but it's not exactly an L. It's on a slam, 45 degree. I would say 8 to 10 feet down there. There was a tree branch that hung right over me. I was behind that, kind of giving me a little camouflage.
Okay. Did you ever see an ambulance come by?
No, I never paid no attention. I wasn't watching the vehicles that passed by. I'm looking at people. I never noticed an ambulance.
You didn't see an ambulance with red lights?
No, I might have heard a siren. I don't remember. I had all that tuned out. I'm in another complete mode. Sirens, lights flashing, ambulances, police. That don't bother me. I'm not there to look for those things. I'm there looking for other details for other things.
Okay, so then what happened? The motorcade came?
I'm checking everything. I got most everybody, and just basically where a lot of different people are standing at. And I want to make sure that there's, like I say, I don't have any cops right next to me because, you know, something happens and I have to shoot. You know, I don't want to have to shoot anybody else unless it becomes a necessity. So I walk away from the fence. I come back over. Secured everything, got it ready. I could hear the rumble, the people murmuring, so you know the motorcade's approaching. So then I got ready, opened it up. I'm holding the Remington Fireball down below the fence at this point. Motorcade come down, I believe that's Main Street there, come down on Houston, turn back around onto Elm there and come down that little side drive there. Oh, when it come down, I made its first right, that's when I brought the weapon up. And then I'm over the fence, and as they come down, made the turn on down there, that's when I started focusing through the scope and following the car. As shots started ringing out, I started counting the shots, but I'm not counting like 1, 2, 3, and 4. I'm counting them miss, 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 because I know we're going for the headshot. So I don't care how many rounds are being fired as long as we get a headshot. But I'm hearing the shots being fired, and I'm counting them as a miss. is a miss. And that's the only thing I'm concerned about. I've got this sign there for the Simmons Freeway that is fixing to come into my field of fire. As far as I can see at this point, President has not been hit in the head at this time. I've seen the body lurch. I know he's been hit. How serious, I don't know. But my last instructions was we're going for headshot. If you have to take a shot, take it. But don't fire unless it's a necessity, unless you really have to. He said, Jimmy, don't fire unless you have to. We want everything from the backside. I'm not asking why. Okay, whatever you say. At this point, as it starts to approach and come behind that freeway sign, and I've already been instructed not to hit anybody but Kennedy because they didn't want Jackie getting hurt or anybody else, I'm fixing to lose my field of fire. And at this point, either I shoot or I can put it in a suitcase and leave, one or the other. I took the shot. I fired one shot only.
And where were you aiming?
Well, I was aiming for his right eye, which to me is the left side of his head looking head on. But for him, it would be his right eye. And once I pull the trigger, I'm right in on it, and it's almost like looking 6 feet away through the scope. As I squeezed, take off my round, his head moved forward, I missed, and I coming right along the temple, just right behind the eye.
Here or in the hairline?
No. All right. Well, I'm not sure because I can't see the penetration. I know I hit him right here. I know I hit behind the eye, somewhere within a half inch diameter right there, say. But
two shots almost simultaneously.
You think he got hit as you were screaming?
What I believe is this, and I got my ratings as a marksman. I'm a good shooter. Always was. And I'm not bragging on myself, don't get me wrong, but that's what got me my start with David Phillips because of something that I did in the service, and I made a mark there, and it's on record and it's recorded for headshots for what I did and the things that I did. But anyway, make a long story short, as I was preparing to squeeze off my round, Kennedy's head moved forward just as I squeezed. It was already in process, the head started forward. To me, what I believe is, and I did not see, let me clear the fact now, I never saw Mr. Nicoletti shoot Kennedy, but I know he was the man in the Dowtech building, the man supposed to be doing the shooting. Therefore, the head started forward. As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Nicoletti hit him at that point. As I squeezed off my round, the head started forward, I hit him and blew the head backwards. I didn't hit the rear, the exit blew out. And you can see Jackie, yeah. A lot of people might say you can't see nothing through a scope, but I'm going to tell you something. When you see something burst, his head like a watermelon, you're going to see pieces of stuff flying different directions, and people are going to be splattered by it. At this point, I got to figure, well, she's going to be picking up a piece of his skull or something, because a lot of people say you can't see nothing through a scope like this. But what you're going to see is like, and I saw it, the head explode. I saw the backside come out. I seen brains or whatever you want to call it, tissue, hair, a whole thing going everywhere, just a spray. And if anybody displeased, just go out and shoot somebody and look through a scope while you're doing it and watch.
Look at this.
And one other thing I'd like to...
Did you see anybody splattered with blood?
I don't know who splattered. I think one of the agents, probably one of the Secret Service agents, riding on the back of the car. I'm only assuming that. I would say they probably got splattered because there was stuff everywhere. But one of the other things I want to point out about Remington 222 Fireball, it's a high-velocity pistol. The round travels approximately 3,180 feet per second. Now then, for this type of weapon, there is very little recoil. Now, a lot of people say there's a lot of recoil, it's going to jump, you can't see nothing. And I've had a lot of criticism over the years over this here. So I'd like for somebody to go out to firing range somewhere, gun store, and take one of these particular types of weapons that carry a 222 round, and fire. You're going to find very little recoil, especially when you're using an extended barrel weapon with a scope on it. You got to wait to hold it down. It's not jumping and bouncing. You're not shooting a 44 or 45.
We have verified all that.
Okay. But,
okay, so did the motorcade ever come to a stop?
The motorcade, the best of my recollection, to me and my mind and everything is slowed down at this point. When they hit, when the first shot went off, it's like it stopped. It's just like it slowed down almost a crawl or barely moving, or maybe it even stopped. I'm not really sure on that point. I know I was waiting. It kept moving. It had to have been moving, but very, very slow. Because I'm waiting for it to get up the sand. I'm waiting for something to happen so I don't have to shoot. Not that I'm afraid to. But if I don't have to, I don't want to. But like I say, when the car got even, almost up to that Simmons Freeway sign there, and that was one of the most, and ain't like these new ones they got today with nice little skinny metal posts and a little sign. These here had, made it, I guess, the wooden legs on, or what do you want to call it, the post that held it was wood. Anyway, though, I had my shot. It's either I shoot now or I don't. I took my shot.
Did you ever notice if any of those rounds hit that sign?
No. Yeah. I don't know if anybody else did or not. As far as I know, their round never hit it. I know my round didn't hit it. Like I say, I fired one shot.
But
I was on target.
Sign, so.
No. I'm watching one thing. Through that scope, I'm watching one thing. I'm watching President John F. Kennedy.
So if a bullet hit the sign, you probably wouldn't have seen it anymore.
No. I didn't even know Conley was hit at that point of the game.
Were you nervous in any way?
Was I nervous? No. If I'd have been nervous, I'd have been shaking. I couldn't have made the shot. A lot of people may find this hard to believe, but you've got to understand something. First time you go into the field of fire, when you go into a firefight in combat, you might be nervous or skimmish. But after you've been initiated into the field of fire, whatever you want to call it, combat, firefights, a lot of people got different names for it, skirmishes.
You get
over it. And, you know, and to me, and a lot of people are really going to think I'm probably sick, but when you got into a firefight, that was the element high. I've never used drugs in my life. A firefight to me, being in the service, that was one of the greatest things there was. It was the ultimate high. And at this point, when you're stalking down somebody, and this particularly, they stopped me from hunting animals altogether. When I was young, I used to love to go shoot deer, rabbit, squirrel, whatever I could get, pheasant. But after you went into the jungles and you've hunted man and you've stalked a man down and you've hunted a man down on equal terms where he can kill you, you have no desire to go shoot a defenseless animal. I become to where I loved animals much more than that. I couldn't kill anyone. When my dog had to be put to sleep, my wife and one of my top right-hand men had to take the dog to the vet because I didn't have the heart to do it.
Were there any, while you were up behind that fence, mostly before the shooting started, was there anyone in your vicinity?
There was nobody behind that stockade fence but me at that point. Nobody. All the time I was there, I was alone. But in front of the fence, the two people that I was mostly concerned about was a couple of guys wearing suits. They were up there on top of the grassy knoll there. And they were a little ways in front, maybe 15, 20 feet away, whatever, you know. I did not know who they were.
In front of the fence would be the railroad yard. Sorry.
Yeah, but the stockade fence.
No,
the stockade fence.
Between the fence and the road.
They're between the fence and the sidewalk, between me and the motorcade.
Okay.
They're on top. They're at the top of the knoll there.
Okay.
They're kind of like looking over everybody and watching people. And this had me a little bit concerned because I don't know who they are. At this stage of the game, well, I'm going to take my shot. I got the 45 ready. If I got two, like I say, I don't want to shoot nobody unless I have to. At this point, and I've checked them, the shoulder holsters, the backside, I saw no bulges. As far as I knew, they wasn't packing. So I figure maybe they're just a couple of businessmen. Just, you know, people want to see the president go by. A lot of people are strange that way. Everybody wants to go see celebrities go by. But I took the shot, and as I was walking away, and like I said, I seen Jackie crawl out there. Motorcycle cop, he threw his bike down. He jumped off, and as he come running in a little zigzag or whatever you want to call it, like he's really into combat or something, he's still a wide open target. Anybody could shoot him. He's got his pistol out. And he's running up the hole there. The two men that at the fence there, seen two guys in the suits, they go over and they open up identifications. So I have to figure these are probably my cover that I've never been informed about. And I was told not to worry. They stopped him, and he never came no farther. He went back down off the knoll.
You were told not to worry.
I was told, Charles Nicoletti told me, he said, when you take the shot, he said, just walk away. He told me, don't run. He said, just walk away natural, Jimmy. He said, don't show no tension. I told him, I said, don't worry. And I had no intention of breaking out of there running. But like I say, if somebody comes at me, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to leave the area. If that shoots somebody else, that's what I'll do at this point of the game.
He said 10, 15 feet or so down from the corner towards the railroad.
8 or 10 feet, something like that, yeah. From the end where the...
Were you close to halfway in the halfway mark of that fence?
No, I wasn't in the middle of the fence. You got your left angle that comes, and you got about a 45-degree angle for the short part of the fence.
Yeah.
Then I'm down maybe 10 feet from there.
Okay.
And there's a tree branch. One branch come right down up the tree there. It covered
so
it real good.
Halfway points on down to your
halfway
right.
Is a little more down to my right.
Okay.
That would have been halfway down.
Did you ever notice a GI, a guy in a khaki uniform?
No, I did not.
Did you notice people on the railroad bridge?
I knew there's people up there, but I didn't pay any attention to them.
They didn't have a good view of you anyway, because you're under
yeah,
the
they were,
cover.
I'm pretty well undercover. The only time people could see me from the viaduct or from the railroad yard is when I was walking down the tracks next to some of the boxcars.
But as you recall it, nobody was with you behind the fence.
I said before, like, there was nobody behind the stockade fence with me. I am the only person back there. Anybody else back there is over in the railroad yard by the trains.
How about down by that corner down there? Did you have a clear view? There's a lot of cars back there, right?
Yeah.
Did you have a clear view? Could somebody have been down around by that corner and you might not have seen?
They could have been down there. couple of cars drove through while I was there, but who they were and what kind they were, I don't even remember because I just wrote it off. As long as nobody got out, nobody come by me, they're no concern.
But shortly before, there was no...
Right before the assassination, there was nobody standing next to me.
How about 3 minutes before the assassination? You
don't Not by me. I was alone back there. I had no other party standing by me. Somebody was there in the yard or down at the other end, you know, 30, 40 feet away. That has no bearing to me because I paid them no attention.
Well, there's this eyewitness report of the guy in the railroad tower.
Well, he might have been the tower, but I'm talking about people on the ground walking up by me or passing me. Or...
No, but he's describing two persons behind the fence.
Well, maybe he's figuring two people when he see me change my jacket and walk away somebody different. I don't know. But I was alone. And there was nobody with me.
All right, so after you walk away and these two guys cover for you, describe your actions then.
Oh, as I'm walking away, I've got my briefcase, gun case in my right hand. I've got my left hand over by my coat pocket. I got a Colt 45 there. I've got it fully loaded with six rounds in it. It's ready to go if I need it.
Oh, and you reversed your jacket.
I've already reversed my jacket. When I picked up the gun keys, I reversed my jacket, no plaid side. I got the poplin gray material on the outside. I took the fedora I had shoved down in the sleeve of it, snapped it out, put it back on my head, and I walked away, carrying the briefcase and my 45 inside my coat pocket.
James Files there. He is the man who assassinated U.S. President John F. Kennedy, working for the Chicago Mafia as a hitman. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download that podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest this week. That was Tim Herford, a musical treat from the Transpersonals with him, looking at the music industry, Free Festival Druids and Arabella Churchill, who started the Glastonbury Festival. Breaking the Spell of Money with Tim. We'll be doing more of that in future weeks. Also, you just heard James Files. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic at Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also, through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the National Volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
So plunge the knife right in. It's, now, if anyone asks, it's not an experiment. It's just cruelty. BBC.
Turn all the boys here.
lot of things been happening in the papers this week. The Today campaign, Today newspaper campaigned every single day against animal cruelty. We'll be looking at that a little bit later on. And also, you may remember last Sunday's, the Sunday People printed pictures of little Prince William relieving himself in the park. For that particular photograph, rather innocent family photograph, you might, something it might crop up in your snapshot LP, the editor was sacked. Later, Mr. Maxwell, Robert Maxwell, who owns the paper, said he would treat the editor, Ms. Henry, generously. But then he rather ambiguously went on to say, a payoff has not been discussed, but I treat editors as the equivalent of field marshals. In other words, they get shot.